You know, if you were to go out and run a marathon right now, it would be, it would be pretty grueling.
Yeah, definitely.
But you could probably do it eventually because with every deep breath you take, your lungs are pulling in the oxygen and your muscles need to just keep moving.
Right, your body's getting the fuel it needs.
Exactly. But now, imagine trying to run that exact same marathon on an incredibly hot day while someone is slowly, imperceptibly, pumping the oxygen out of the air around you.
Oh man, that changes the math entirely. It shifts from a simple test of endurance to a fundamental crisis of biology.
Right.
You're suddenly demanding more fuel than the environment can physically supply,
Right.
and your metabolic engine is just going to stall out.
You would hit a wall so fast. And while we obviously don't have to worry about the atmosphere suddenly running out of oxygen while we jog, for the marine life in our oceans, that terrifying scenario is rapidly becoming their daily reality.
It really is. It's happening right now.
So today, our mission for this deep dive is to uncover this invisible, high-stakes underwater dance of temperature and oxygen. We're going to explore how it dictates whether marine life thrives or completely vanishes.
And we have a really fascinating single source for this.
Yes, a highly detailed 2024 scientific paper from the journal Ecological Indicators. And it focuses entirely on what this single ecosystem, the Yangtze Estuary in China, can teach us about the future of the global ocean.
It's a brilliant study, honestly.
It is. Just to set the stage for you real quick, the Yangtze Estuary is China's largest temperate estuary. It's this massive, incredibly dynamic convergence point where the fresh water rushing from the Yangtze River collides head-on with the salty water of the ocean.
It's highly productive. I mean, it's a biological hotspot teeming with life.
Right. But is under intense compounding stress from climate change. Okay, let's unpack this, because to really understand how fish survive in this chaotic environment, we first have to understand the fundamental currency of marine life.
And that currency is, without a doubt, oxygen. The researchers in this study introduced two vital, honestly groundbreaking, ecological indicators to measure this underwater economy. They call them MODC and AGC.
Okay, lay those out for us.
Sure. So MODC stands for the mean oxygen demand of the community, and AGC stands for the aerobic growth index of the community.
Those were definitely mouthfuls. So to visualize this for you, let's think of a major city's power grid during a massive summer heat wave.
That's a great way to look at it.
MODC is essentially the demand side of the equation. It's the total amount of electricity being pulled from the grid because everyone in the city has their air conditioners blasting on high.
Right, so in the ocean, that MODC is the total oxygen that all the fish, the crabs, the squid, everything, it's what they desperately need to maintain their metabolism.
Just to swim and digest food.
Exactly, to swim, evade predators, all of it. And then the other half of that equation, AGC, that represents the supply viability.
The power plant.
Right. Can the city's power plant generate enough electricity to keep all those air conditioners running without blowing a fuse? So AGA measures whether the habitat has enough dissolved oxygen available to meet the demands of that specific marine community.
And there's a specific threshold they look at, right?
Yes. If the AGAA score falls below the value of one, well, the habitat becomes metabolically unviable.
The biological grid basically fails.
Exactly. Rolling blackouts, but for fish.
What fascinates me here is the physics of how temperature drives both sides of this equation, but in completely opposite directions.
It's totally wild.
Right? As ocean temperatures rise, a fish's body temperature rises too because, you know, they're cold-blooded.
Their internal enzymes speed up.
Yeah, their metabolism just races. And so their needing for oxygen, their MODC demand, completely spikes.
But what's fascinating here is the cruel paradox of that exact mechanism. Because of just the basic kinetic properties of water, warmer water actually holds less dissolved oxygen than cold water.
Which is just brutal timing.
It really is. When water molecules heat up, they move faster, which literally allows dissolved gases, like oxygen, to escape back into the atmosphere.
Wow.
So right when the marine life needs oxygen the absolute most, the physical environment is actively holding less of it.
It's like the power plant actively reducing its output right as everyone turns their AC units up to maximum.
Perfect analogy. It's a physiological trap. And the researchers proved this mathematically in the paper. They showed a stark positive correlation between temperature and oxygen demand.
So when the water gets warmer, the collective gasp for air just gets louder.
It gets much louder, which really forces us to look at how this ecosystem functions over time. Because the Yangtze estuary isn't some temperature-controlled aquarium, you know?
Right. It's a temperate estuary, so it experiences these dramatic seasonal shifts.
Huge shifts. And the data here tells a really paradoxical story about spring versus autumn. The biological communities in these two seasons are so distinct that just 15 specific species account for nearly 99% of the biomass differences between them.
Wait, 99% turnover?
Yeah, 99%.
That is basically a completely new cast of characters just moving into the neighborhood every few months.
Exactly. It's a total swap.
But let's look at the raw data for a second, because I want to push back on this. Right. We know that autumn in the estuary is significantly warmer than spring.
Right. It is.
And based on the physics we just broke down, warmer water means much higher oxygen demand and a lower oxygen supply.
Correct.
So logically, shouldn't the autumn community be the one on the brink of collapse? Like, shouldn't autumn be the season where we see these biological blackouts?
You would completely think so, based just on temperature. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, we find the exact opposite is happening.
Really?
Yeah. The autumn community actually possesses a higher total biomass and significantly greater stability. The autumn habitat proves far less vulnerable to hypoxia, you know, that state of low oxygen, than the spring habitat.
Wait, I must be missing something in the math here. The demand is at its peak. The supply is being throttled by the late summer heat. Yet the fish are doing better. Are they just, I don't know, magically ignoring their own biology?
No magic involved, unfortunately. It all comes down to evolutionary adaptation and life cycles.
Okay, how so?
Well, the species that dominate the estuary in autumn are animals like the hairtail, which is this long, aggressive, predatory fish, or various types of swimming crabs. These are specifically warm water adapted species.
Ah.
Over millennia, they have evolved a naturally higher thermal tolerance. Their metabolic engines are basically designed to run hot without burning out.
Okay, so it's not the same fish just stubbornly enduring the heat.
Mm-hmm.
The cold water vulnerable fish have simply evacuated.
Exactly. They've migrated out to cooler waters. But the life stage of the remaining fish is just as crucial here.
Life stage, like how old they are.
Right. In autumn, the estuary functions essentially as a feeding ground for larger, mature fish that have already finished spawning for the year. They are bulky, resilient adults.
They have reserves.
Exactly. Spring, however, serves as the nursery.
Ah, the breeding season.
Yes. The water in spring is just filled with smaller fry, delicate larvae, and adult species that are actively burning immense amounts of energy to reproduce.
Wow. Okay. So even though the overall oxygen demand is technically lower in the spring because the water is cooler, the actual individuals living there, the newly hatched larvae, the exhausted spawning adults, they're operating with a razor-thin margin for error?
Exactly. They are so much more fragile. To quantify that fragility, the researchers use a statistical tool called a cumulative distribution function.
Sounds complicated.
It's just a way of mapping out a survival curve for the entire community. Think of it like a graph. In spring, that survival curve resembles a steep cliff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If the oxygen supply drops even a tiny fraction of a milligram, you don't just lose a few weak fish. A massive percentage of the entire community is suddenly pushed right over the edge, falling below that critical agency viability threshold of one.
So a tiny fluctuation just wipes out the nursery.
Pretty much, yeah. Whereas the autumn community, despite operating in a high heat, high demand environment, has a much gentler survival curve.
Because the adults have the physiological buffer to ride out temporary drops in oxygen.
Right. They can handle a bad day or two. And that fundamentally reframes how we should look at climate change.
Right. Because it's not just a blanket statement that warming is bad.
No. The timing of the warming relative to the biological calendar dictates the severity of the disaster.
Yeah.
Ecosystem management becomes incredibly complex when you realize you can't just read a surface thermometer to gauge the health of a fishery.
You have to know exactly who is in the water.
Exactly. Are they an adult building fat reserves or a fragile larva just trying to survive its first week?
That makes total sense. So the seasons dictate when marine life is most vulnerable. But the study also reveals another layer of complexity regarding where you look in the estuary.
Geography is destiny here, truly.
Yeah, the researchers identified a very specific coordinate in the data, which was the latitude line of 30 degrees 20 minutes north.
Right, the 30-20 line.
So if you were a fish living north of this invisible line, your habitat viability is generally quite high.
You're doing pretty well.
But if you cross south of that line, the data shows these extensive severe zones of high temperature and low oxygen. And I'm looking at this on a map, and it's just open water.
It looks completely uniform from the surface.
Right. So why would crossing an invisible GPS coordinate suddenly plunge the habitat into a toxic state? Is there like a massive underwater trench or a physical wall blocking the water flow?
You might expect a canyon or a massive underwater ridge there, but no, the seabed is actually relatively uniform. The barrier isn't made of rock, it's made of fluid dynamics.
Fluid dynamics.
Yeah, it's a massive clash of different water masses. So first, the southern region of the survey area is slightly deeper, and intruding into this deeper area from the south is a massive flow of ocean water called the Taiwan Warm Current.
Okay, and a warm current brings heat, which we know spikes oxygen demand. But ocean currents usually keep water moving and mixing, don't they?
Usually, yes, but the Taiwan Warm Current is highly saline.
Meaning very salty.
Incredibly salty and therefore very dense and heavy. So as it pushes north into the estuary, its sheer weight causes it to slide in underneath the surface waters, just hugging the ocean floor.
Okay, I picture that.
But at the exact same time, you have millions of gallons of runoff from the Yangtze River pouring out over the top of the estuary.
And river water is fresh, so it completely lacks salt, making it physically lighter.
Exactly. It's fresh, it's warm from flowing over land, and it just floats right on top. What you end up with is intense stratification.
Stratification, like the layers.
Yes, it's like a cocktail where the bartender has carefully layered different colored liquors that just refuse to mix together.
Oh, that's a great image.
The light river water forms a thick ceiling on top, and the dense, heavy Taiwan warm current is trapped on the bottom.
And this effectively prevents any vertical mixing. The deep water can't cycle up to the surface to absorb new oxygen from the atmosphere.
It acts as a heavy physical lid. Whatever oxygen is trapped in that bottom layer gets rapidly consumed by the marine life and the bacteria down there.
And because of the lid, it never gets replenished.
Never. The southern waters lock into a severe, prolonged state of hypoxia.
Wow. So what does this all mean? If you're a casual observer, you might think, well, the fish in the south will just swim north to the better water. Right. Problem solved.
If only it were that simple.
Right. Because this geographical divide has massive real-world implications, particularly when human economics enter the picture. Fish are highly mobile. They aren't going to just sit in the deep water and suffocate. As those low oxygen zones expand, they flee.
They migrate rapidly away from the suffocation zones, desperately seeking out the remaining pockets of highly oxygenated water.
But by doing that, they are essentially being pushed into a shrinking room. They are forced out of the vast deep waters where they are naturally dispersed and much harder to catch.
And they crowd into these shallow, high oxygen wreckages. They become incredibly concentrated.
Which creates a terrifying optical illusion for the commercial fishing industry.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine a fishing fleet tracks this massive, dense school of fish into one of these shallow refuges. They drop their nets and pull in just a record-breaking haul. Looking at the deck of their ship, they probably assume the ecosystem is thriving.
Because they see sheer volume.
Right. They don't realize they aren't looking at a healthy, booming population. They are looking at biological refugees.
That's exactly what they are.
They've just scooped up the last desperate survivors, huddled in the only breathable corner of the estuary. This spatial squeezing dramatically accelerates overfishing.
It takes a population that is already deeply stressed by climate change and makes them utterly defenseless to human harvesting.
The double whammy.
Exactly. If fishery managers are only looking at the total tonnage of fish caught without understanding the spatial distribution of habitat viability, they will set quotas dangerously high.
They might think the ocean is full of fish right up until the day the nets come up completely empty.
It's a very real danger.
Fundamentally changes how we have to view the ocean. It's not one giant uniform bathtub. It's a shifting patchwork of microhabitats where the invisible walls are built entirely out of temperature and salt.
A shifting maze, really.
Now, over the nearly 2 decades tracked in this study from 2004 to 2022, this delicate system bent, but it largely didn't break.
Right, the overall habitat viability mostly hovered above that critical threshold of one.
Mostly. Except for one terrifying event recorded in the data.
Ah, yes. The spring of 2004.
What happened?
The data from that season shows that dissolved oxygen levels across the estuary completely crashed. The Aegis, you know, the supply metric, it plummeted far below the viability threshold. It was a rapid mass suffocation event.
The entire localized grid just went dark. What triggered it?
It was a domino effect, and it was initiated by an explosion of jellyfish.
Jellyfish?
Yeah. In the spring of 2004, the region experienced a massive jellyfish bloom. Now, jellyfish blooms are often triggered by nutrient runoff, so agricultural fertilizers washing down the Yangtze River.
Right, which creates an algae explosion.
Exactly. The algae feeds the zooplankton, and then the jellyfish just feast on the zooplankton.
And jellyfish are remarkably resilient to low oxygen, right? So they thrive while other fish start to really struggle.
They do. But the real crisis doesn't happen when the jellyfish are alive. It happens when they die.
Oh.
Their life cycles are short, and when millions of them die simultaneously, their bodies just sink to the floor of the estuary,
creating a massive gelatinous graveyard.
Beautifully put. And in the ocean, a graveyard is just a buffet for bacteria.
Right.
The bacteria begins decomposing this overwhelming volume of organic matter. But decomposition is an aerobic process.
Meaning the bacteria require oxygen to break down the jellyfish carcasses.
Exactly. Because the volume of death was so unnaturally high, the bacteria multiplied exponentially and effectively vacuumed every last molecule of dissolved oxygen out of the surrounding water.
They suffocate the environment just by cleaning it up. So the jellyfish die. The bacteria gorge themselves, the oxygen drops to zero, and the traditional fish community collapses. But here's where it gets really interesting.
Right.
Amidst this apocalyptic biological blackout, the data shows one incredibly bizarre survivor. A fish that didn't just endure the 2004 crash, but actively took over the estuary.
Yes, a species scientifically known as Harpodon nereus.
Also known as the Bombay duck.
In culinary circles, yes, the Bombay duck.
The Bombay duck absolutely dominated. In the zones with the most severe hypoxia, this one species accounted for up to 91% of the total biomass.
91%. It's staggering.
The ecosystem collapsed, and the Bombay duck essentially claimed the ruins. When you look at the biology of how we pull this off, it is a masterclass in evolutionary hacking.
But our biology is entirely unique.
Yeah, talk about that, because this blew my mind.
Well, most coastal fish possess muscle and tissue that is roughly 75 to 80% water. But the Bombay duck's body tissue is remarkably gelatinous. It's composed of approximately 90% water.
90%? That sounds like a trivial distinction, but physiologically, it changes everything.
Everything.
If your body is 90% water, you don't have dense muscle mass or heavy skeletal structures to maintain. You are practically just a floating sack of water with teeth.
A floating sack of water with teeth. That is highly accurate. And what that does is radically lower their resting metabolic rate.
Because they lack that dense, metabolically expensive tissue.
Exactly. Their baseline oxygen demand, their MODC, is a fraction of a normal fish's. They require significantly less electricity from the power grid just to exist.
Furthermore, they don't even need a traditional swim bladder for buoyancy, because their watery tissue makes them naturally buoyant, saving them even more energy.
They're just incredibly efficient.
They also happen to have a naturally high thermal tolerance. So when the water heats up and the bacteria suck all the oxygen out, the Bombay duck doesn't go into metabolic shock.
No, it just settles into the suffocating water and outcompetes absolutely everything else that is either fleeing or dying. This raises an important question, though.
Which is,
how should we interpret the sudden dominance of a creature like the Bombay duck? Because when fishermen suddenly start pulling up nets brimming with nothing but jellyfish and Bombay duck, it's really easy to view it as just a quirky, localized biological anomaly. You know, just a weird year for fishing.
But it's not just a weird year. It's the ecosystem screaming at us.
Exactly.
You often hear the phrase canary in the coal mine, but I think that's the wrong analogy here.
Hmm.
A canary dies when things get bad.
Yeah.
The Bombay duck is more like a biological smoke detector.
Oh, I like that.
It's the alarm that starts blaring. It's thriving in the exact conditions that are lethal to everything else.
Monitoring the population spikes of these highly specific hypoxia-tolerant species provides us with real-time intelligence.
It's an irrefutable signal.
It is. It tells us that the underlying habitat is degrading, that the invisible oxygen supply is crashing, and that the diverse traditional community of marine life is actively collapsing right beneath the surface.
Synthesizing this entire journey, you know, we've uncovered that the Yangtze Estuary is this remarkably complex, resilient, yet highly stressed engine.
It's a delicate balance.
Over two decades, it has mostly maintained its biological power grid. but the overarching lesson from the seasonal paradoxes, the impenetrable fluid walls of the Taiwan warm current and the 2004 jellyfish collapse, is that climate change and ocean deoxygenation are violently non-uniform.
They do not happen everywhere all at once to every species equally.
Right. A spring larva is devastated by a temperature spike that an autumn adult easily ignores.
And the deep southern waters suffocate under a dense, salty lid while the northern waters breathe freely.
Which means our entire philosophy regarding conservation and fishery management has to completely evolve.
We can no longer rely on rigid, static policies?
No. A calendar-based rule like the traditional May to August fishing ban mentioned by the researchers is an incredibly blunt instrument.
Too blunt for what we're facing now.
It might offer protection during the vulnerable spring spawning, sure, but it completely misses the mark if a sudden intrusion of the Taiwan warm current triggers a catastrophic hypoxic event in late September.
Conservation must become hyperlocalized. It has to adapt to shifting currents, specific seasonal life stages, and real-time environmental metrics.
And that actually leads me to a really provocative thought to leave you with today.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've spent this entire deep dive exploring how the ocean's power grid fluctuates dynamically based on temperature, biology, and physical geography. What if we manage human activity with that exact same dynamism?
You're talking about abandoning static quotas entirely.
Exactly. Imagine a near-future scenario where we deploy an AI-driven fishery management grid.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We have the technology now to feed real-time satellite data on surface temperatures, combined with data from autonomous underwater gliders measuring salinity and dissolved oxygen right at the seafloor directly into a centralized AI.
So an algorithm that is constantly calculating the live MODC and AGC for every single square kilometer of the estuary.
Yes. It would create a live breezing map of the ocean's oxygen economy.
That is incredible to think about.
And based on that real-time data, authorities could open and close specific fishing zones dynamically, day by day, or even hour by hour.
So responsive.
If the AI detects that heavy, salty lid forming in a specific southern sector and predicts that fish are about to be squeezed into a shallow refuge, that specific grid square is instantly closed to commercial fleets for 48 hours.
You prevent the slaughter before it even happens.
Exactly. You protect the biological refugees until the physical currents shift and the deep water reoxygenates, allowing the population to disperse safely again.
And conversely, if a northern sector shows high oxygen viability and really strong biological resilience, fishing is permitted there.
Right. We align our economic harvesting directly with the actual momentary biological reality of the ecosystem. We stop managing the ocean based on the paper calendar on our wall and start managing it based on the very breath in the water.
As this study beautifully illustrates, the invisible dynamics of supply and demand are already writing the future of our oceans.
They really are.
By understanding the intricate biology of these indicators, we actually gain the ability to see the invisible. We can map the fluid walls, track the biological smoke detectors, and fundamentally adapt our relationship with the ocean before the grid suffers a permanent blackout.
It requires looking past the surface waves and truly understanding the physics and biology of the deep. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking beneath the surface, and we will catch you next time.